KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
A truce between India and Pakistan. Then accusations of violations of the agreement. We'll hear the latest from our correspondent in Mumbai on this moment of tension between two nuclear powers. For Saturday, May 10th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Rome, where this week the Catholic Church elevated an American to the papacy for the first time in its history. We'll talk about it with one of the men in the conclave, New York Cardinal Timothy Dolan.
I think, though, the arrival of a new pope from wherever he came usually brings a bit of a hint of regeneration.
And in our Reporter's Notebook series, we will hear from one of NPR's most iconic voices, Sylvia Fagioli, about what it's like to cover the Vatican. Plus, reaction in Hollywood to President Trump's film tariffs.
We have generations of people who have been in this business who are in this area, and we need to protect that.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Russian President Putin is proposing direct talks with Ukraine in Istanbul, May 15th, quote, without preconditions. This is European Union leaders today were in Ukraine pressing him to accept a 30-day unconditional ceasefire or face more sanctions. NPR's Charles Maines reports the Kremlin says any deal would require a halt to Western military support to Kyiv.
Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov made the comments in an interview with ABC This Week's Martha Raddatz.
If we do a temporary ceasefire...
You want the weapons stopped.
Otherwise, it will be an advantage for Ukraine.
Peskov said without a stoppage in weapon shipments to Ukraine, Kyiv could use the pause to rearm and replenish troops. The spokesman insisted President Vladimir Putin continues to support a U.S.-backed peace settlement, but would also maintain military operations until such a deal was in place. Peskov's comments came as Kyiv and Moscow each accused the other of violating a three-day Russian-declared ceasefire to mark the 80th anniversary of the Soviet Union's victory over Nazi Germany in World War II. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
India is accusing Pakistan of breaching a temporary truce between the two nuclear-powered countries, brokered by the U.S. But Pakistan's foreign ministry says India is to blame for initiating the ceasefire violation. Recent fighting has been the most severe escalation between the two countries in decades. NPR's Dia Hadid has more on what's next.
We know the two sides are meant to speak to each other again on Monday. And so far it appears that a series of punitive measures that both sides had announced following that militant attack in late April are not going to be reversed. Most importantly, that includes India's suspension of a decades-old water treaty with Pakistan. And Pakistan describes that suspension as an existential threat. So even if the ceasefire holds, there's still a lot to tackle.
NPR's Dia Hadid in Mumbai. After canceling in-person classes at the National Fire Academy, the Trump administration is now pledging to restore funding to the facility, which trains tens of thousands of firefighters across the country. NPR's Frank Langford reports.
During a hearing Thursday, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said the administration would restore funding to the academy. Quote, those grants and programs are being facilitated and those dollars will be forwarded, she said, responding to questions from Senator Chris Van Hollen, a Democrat from Maryland. Noem did not say why the administration was restoring funding. The statement was welcome news to the nation's firefighters who rely on the academy for high-level training. It was also a relief for Emmitsburg, a tiny town in western Maryland which is home to the academy. Emmitsburg voted overwhelmingly for Trump in November. Trump supporters there had told NPR they were dumbfounded by the decision to cut training for first responders.
NPR's Frank Langford reporting. You're listening to NPR. Earlier this year, Eurasian lynx were spotted in the Scottish Highlands, animals that hadn't roamed that landscape for hundreds of years. Officials say they were released illegally. NPR's Jacob Fenston reports it may be a setback to reintroduction efforts.
The four lynx were quickly caught, but whoever set them loose wasn't. It may be a case of rogue rewilding, where vigilantes attempt to reintroduce a species on their own. There's been a backlash. The Scottish First Minister now says there won't be any official lynx reintroduction on his watch. Peter Cairns with the nonprofit Scotland The Big Picture says there's no need to fear these native wild cats.
Ecologically speaking, we know that these animals are important. We know that apex predators play a vital role in maintaining healthy ecosystems.
The UK has seen previous cases of suspected rogue rewilding, including butterflies, wild boars, and beavers. It's been dubbed beaver bombing. Jacob Fenston, NPR News.
Well, the most popular names for newborn boys and girls in 2024 is out. This is according to the Social Security Administration. Olivia and Emma, numbers 1 and 2, respectively, for girls. And for the boys, Liam and Noah. Now, both of those, it's the sixth year in a row for both of those names, both 1 and 2. Oliver and Amelia took third place. The Social Security Administration, which releases the top names just before Mother's Day, which is tomorrow, gets their list when parents apply for a Social Security card for their new baby. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at MelvilleTrust.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Rome. After days where India and Pakistan appeared locked into widening conflict, President Trump announced that the two countries had agreed to a ceasefire. And with that, it appeared that the worst conflict in more than 50 years between these nuclear powers had come to a halt. Has it, though? Late Saturday, both sides have been accusing each other of violations of the agreement. NPR's Dia Hadid has been covering this conflict with all of its whiplash. She covers South Asia and joins us from Mumbai.
Hi, Scott.
So there's a ceasefire for now between Pakistan and India?
Well, just hours after it was announced by President Trump, it seems a ceasefire is being violated in Kashmir. That's the Himalayan territory that's divided between India and Pakistan and claimed by both. Residents tell NPR there that they've been hearing the sounds of blasts over two major cities, Jammu and Srinagar. NPR producer Bilal Koche is in Srinagar, and he told us at first that people thought these were fireworks to celebrate the ceasefire. But pretty quickly, people began rushing home to shelter in place. He sent us videos of the city entirely blacked out. Plumes of smoke were streaming down, and people could hear sounds like these. And then the chief minister of Indian health, Kashmir, who's in Srinagar, posted on X, what the hell just happened to the ceasefire?
I mean, so as we try and report out that key question, let's back up and talk about what the American role was in brokering this agreement.
Yeah, for days, analysts were saying that the Americans were not being serious. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is just making phone calls. He hasn't come. But experts tell me as the situation escalated, America did intervene directly, as well as through Arab allies, to convince both parties.
But again, let's get back to where we started this conversation. It seems like this ceasefire is looking incredibly rocky right now.
Yeah, and it's not clear whether this is a small violation or a great unraveling.
This is a decades-long tense relationship, of course, but catch us up to speed on how these two countries got to this dangerous moment right now.
Yeah, these renewed tensions, they really flared in late April when gunmen opened fire on tourists in Indian-held Kashmir and killed 26 people. India said the group that claimed responsibility was a proxy for Pakistan's army, something Pakistan denies. Overnight Wednesday, India began military strikes, and the two countries have been exchanging fire every night since. On Saturday, this morning, India had actually struck some Pakistani air bases, including one near the capital, Islamabad, and that prompted Pakistan to announce an intensified military operation. The fighting was ongoing until about 3 p.m. India time, and then the ceasefire was announced a little bit later. And Scott, just to give you a sense of this, more than 70 people have been killed on both sides, most of them in Kashmir. And these hostilities were the most serious between the two countries since 1971, when India and Pakistan were last officially at war. And this matters because both countries are nuclear powers, and between them, they hold about a fifth of the world's population.
What happens next, as far as we can tell?
We know the two sides are meant to speak to each other again on Monday. And so far it appears that a series of punitive measures that both sides had announced following that militant attack in late April are not going to be reversed. Most importantly, that includes India's suspension of a decades-old water treaty with Pakistan that divides six rivers between them. And Pakistan describes that suspension as an existential threat. So even if the ceasefire holds, there's still a lot to tackle.
That is NPR's Dia Hadid joining us from Mumbai. Thank you so much for your reporting.
You're welcome, Scott.
Ten American cardinals went into the Sistine Chapel for a conclave this past week. Nine came out.
Where he comes from is sort of now a thing of the past. You know, Robert Francis Prevost is no longer around. It's now Pope Leo.
That's the Archbishop of New York, Cardinal Timothy Dolan, reflecting on the fact that he and 132 other cardinals selected Chicago-born Robert Prevost as the head of the Roman Catholic Church. On Wednesday morning, the cardinals sealed themselves off from the rest of the world. Cardinal Joseph Tobin, the Archbishop of Newark, recalled the moment as he, Dolan, and four other U.S. cardinals spoke to reporters in Rome.
Any device that could transmit was taken from us.
The shutters of the guest house they all stayed in, the Casa Santa Marta, were closed shut. Cell signals around the building were jammed. The food, Dolan said, wasn't great. And yet, Cardinal Wilton Gregory, the former head of the Washington, D.C. Archdiocese, said,
"This was one of the most prayerful moments in my life."
After the cardinal selected Pope Leo, they each approached him, one by one, at the altar in front of Michelangelo's fresco of the Last Judgment.
I felt comfortable saying to Pope Leo, from one Southsider of Chicago to another, "I promise you my respect, my fidelity, and my love."
After one of the ballots, you know, you carry your ballot, you deposit it, and you say a few words in Latin.
Tobin has known and worked with Prevost for three decades.
Then I walked back and I took a look at Bob, and he had his head in his hands. And I was praying for him because I couldn't imagine what happens to a human being when you're facing something like that.
But when Bob, as Tobin was calling him, became Pope Leo, Tobin said everything seemed to change.
All of whatever anguish was resolved by the feeling that I think that this wasn't simply his saying yes to a proposal, but God had made something clear and he agreed with it.
Speaking in Italian to the cardinals this weekend, Pope Leo told them he chose his name to honor Pope Leo XIII, who spoke up for workers' rights and social justice during the Industrial Revolution. Pope Leo XIV said the world is at a similar turning point. To get a sense of what this means for the Catholic Church in America and the world, I talked to Cardinal Timothy Dolan.
Cardinal Dolan, welcome to All Things Considered.
Nice to be here. Thanks for asking.
What went through your mind when you realized the conclave was about to elect the first American pope?
We really hadn't thought of him as a cardinal from the United States. Now, by that doesn't mean we were extraordinarily proud and kind of excited about it. I'm an historian of the Catholic Church of the United States. We are always considered bambini. We're considered babies. Because for us, when you've been around 2,000 years, they look to us like rookies, okay? What struck me, we've grown up. We've come of age. We got the car keys. We can drive. I hope that gives a sense of not just pride, because that's transient, but a sense of gratitude from where we've come and to where we're going. I think that it could be a real booster shot for the Catholic family in the United States.
Do you think that changes the Vatican at all? Do you think that changes the church in the United States, given the fact that the Pope is a Chicago native?
I hope so. We need change. We always need change. You know the old Latin phrase, Ecclesia Semper Reformanda. The church is always in need of renewal. So if it does, all the better. I think, though, the arrival of a new pope from wherever he came usually brings a bit of a hint of regeneration that we need. Is this going to be a bit more discernible in the United States because we have a pope who was born in Chicago? and who happens to be a White Sox, not a Cubs fan, because I asked him. That was kind of essential.
This has been a key question. You got a clear answer?
Because I said, I'm from St. Louis, and we can't stand the Cubs. And he said, before I told him that bias, he had told me he's a White Sox fan.
When you left the conclave and caught up with the rest of the world, you must have noticed that many people were reading this as a referendum on American politics, on American leadership of the world. I know you and the other cardinals pushed back on that and the press conference today. Let me ask this. Did global politics, did geopolitics enter into your mind at all when you were thinking about who you wanted to select to lead the Catholic Church at this moment?
Sure it would have, but not as far as personalities or nations. It would have been more in the sense that the successor of Peter has to be a bridge builder, a pontiff, and has to be able in a very conversational, friendly, yet cogent way, present to the leaders of the world the enduring gospel values that have to illuminate the choices that they're making. So that would, you bet that was part of it. Did I read it as as maybe empowering this pope to be particularly cogent in his dealings with superpowers because he's from the United States? No.
What will you... Without excommunicating yourself, what will you remember from this conclave, from this experience in the Sistine Chapel, being part of the election of the next pope?
Well, it wasn't my first rodeo, remember, because I was there in 2013. So surprises, no. The only surprise was that the surprises of the first time were repeated and renewed in a very fresh way.
How so?
So I thought I would say, I'm used to this, okay? When the balloting, when he won, the exhilaration... When they said, you've just been elected Roman pontiff, do you accept? And he said, I accept. Exhilaration. When he went in and changed into the white cassock of the pope and sat in the empty chair that was no longer empty, exhilaration. When we heard the ecstasy of the crowd, when they said, Habemus Papam, exhilaration like kids on Christmas morning. And here are seasoned cardinals that have been through 9 innings and even extra innings who were moved to tears because of the excitement of the moment.
Lastly, is it a tough break for New York that the Pope's from Chicago?
Listen, no comment.
Gotta ask. Cardinal Timothy Dolan, Archbishop of New York, thank you so much.
Way to go. Thank you.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. India is accusing Pakistan of reaching a temporary truce between the two nuclear-powered countries, brokered by the U.S. But Pakistan's foreign ministry says India is to blame for initiating the ceasefire violation. Recent fighting has been the most severe escalation between the two countries in decades. The leaders of four European countries were in Ukraine today in a joint show of support, calling on Russia to agree to a month-long ceasefire in the war. They and President Trump are pushing Russia to agree to that 30-day ceasefire to allow for peace talks to continue. And a magnitude 4.1 earthquake struck Tennessee this morning, and it was felt in Atlanta and western North Carolina. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Made in Cookware, Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at MadeInCookware.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Rome. At a moment when the rest of the world is constantly responding and reacting to the moves and statements of the Trump administration, the new head of the Roman Catholic Church is an American. And while cardinals like former Washington, D.C. Archbishop Wilton Gregory are downplaying any political dynamic to this election,
I didn't sense in the conversations that I had with the other cardinals of the world that the conclave was seen as a continuation of the American political election.
The way that Pope Leo XIV chooses to engage or not engage with global politics is a major open question. And I want to talk more about this with Congressman Brendan Boyle, a Democrat who met with Pope Francis and who is part of the U.S. delegation to the late pontiff's funeral. Thanks for joining us.
Wonderful to be with you at this exciting time.
Look, before we have that broader conversation, I have to ask you, a Pennsylvania congressman, have you adjusted to the fact that the Pope is a Villanova graduate?
It is incredible that we now have a direct link from the Big Five to the Vatican. and probably there are so many memes over the last few days from all of my Chicago friends, and that connection combined with, of course, all of us here in the Philadelphia area. But one of perhaps the best was someone tweeting, "I just came to the realization I probably ate at the same Wawa as the Pope."
I think as much as I would like to continue talking about the Pope eating at Wawa, when you're talking about a Pope in politics, I do think we should start by looking back at Pope Francis. You were there when he addressed Congress 10 years ago. One of the last things that Pope Francis did was rebuke Vice President Vance on the topic of immigration. What was Francis's broad impact on American politics?
Well, first, I mean, his style and his humility had a really profound impact. Truly, the day I saw most members of Congress and staffers just the happiest was the day that Pope Francis came and visited Capitol Hill and spoke to a joint session of Congress, becoming the only pope to do so. And I point that out regardless of the issues of the church, some of which might more neatly align with liberal positions of the Democratic Party, some of which will align with more conservative politics of the Republican Party. The reality is Pope Francis was supported by upwards of 90% of American Catholics and a lot of people in the United States who aren't Catholic or perhaps not even all that religious really did admire Pope Francis. And I think that what you will see is a continuation, not necessarily of the same style, but a continuation in terms of the papacy having a very warm place in the hearts of most Americans.
Francis did use that pulpit, though, to at times be pretty pointed, whether it was in press conferences with reporters or letters or statements like that. Obviously, Pope Leo is a different person with a very different style, at least as far as we can see in the first few days of his papacy. Do you expect him to wade into issues like immigration?
Well, first, I mean, already from some of the previous homilies that I've seen, then Cardinal Prevost, and even before that, Father Bob, giving, he just has a very calm, deliberate style. He already, you can tell, has stylistic differences because, of course, he's a different person. That said, it's not as if Catholic teaching on immigration or the dignity of the poor or life issues, none of that's going to change.
I guess you as a policymaker, as a Catholic, what do you want to see from this man? And what do you want to see particularly as an American from this American Pope?
You know, I observe that over the last 15, 20 years, we're in a democracy recession worldwide. We have seen the rise of authoritarianism all around the world, a weakening of small d democratic norms. So to have a major world leader, perhaps the most famous world leader, seen as a moral authority, as a consistent voice for the poor, for light, for peace, particularly at this time, it is absolutely needed. I think it's needed in the United States and it's needed around the world. So for Catholics and non-Catholics alike, I think that this Pope in particular could play a key role at a very sensitive moment mm-hmm. in world history.
We talked before about that moment when Pope Francis addressed Congress. What are your hopes for an American Pope to come in and address Congress?
Well, it was exciting to have Pope Francis not only address Congress, but then a few days later in Philadelphia for the World Meeting of Families, I was able to be with him in a prison in my congressional district in Northeast Philadelphia. That's where I had the opportunity to shake his hand. I remember how he went individually to every single prisoner who was there and prayed with each one of them as individuals. It was an incredible moment and a very moving one. Now with the new Pope, I hope that we make it two papal visits in a row. I certainly think he would want to return to his alma mater at Villanova. So I think that a lot of us have high hopes that we'll have a papal visit at some point in the next year or two.
Congressman Brendan Boyle, Democrat from Pennsylvania. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
My colleague Elsa Chang recently spent some time talking with NPR staffers about the movies. It is the latest in our regular series, Cineplexity. Here's Elsa.
So for as long as we've had movies, we have had horror movies.
What's your favorite scary movie?
Here's Johnny.
And we seek these films out because sometimes we just want to be terrified. We want to be shocked or grossed out. But, you know, sometimes that is exhilarating. Of course, also, sometimes we might just be too young. Kids are drawn to horror, too. And I'm not just talking about movies like Goosebumps. I'm talking about really scary stuff. So, what's a healthy little scare for kids? And what is potentially scarring? Well, we wanted to talk to two people who have had broadly different experiences when it comes to thinking about horror movies for kids. All Things Considered producer and film buff Megan Lim.
Hey, hey.
And NPR music and pop culture critic and father of two young adults now, Stephen Thompson. Hey.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Great to have you both. Okay, so I don't have kids, so this isn't like a question I personally wrestle with, but I do remember being a kid and how, like, to this day, there are certain horrifying images that remain burned into my brain after being exposed to them as a young child. Like, for me, perhaps one of the earliest movies that traumatized me to the core was Piranha.
Such a good one.
No, not such a good one, because it's about a swarm of like these killer piranhas and people would accidentally fall out of boats, right? And be eaten alive and the water would get all bloody. And it made me afraid to swim in any body of water for like years if I couldn't see through the water. So, you know, yeah. So there are certain films that can have these lasting, terrible effects on a child's psychology. And I'm just wondering for you guys, what's like the earliest image, horror movie or not, that scared the bleep out of you?
Oh, my God. For me, my go-to answer for this is it was The Mummy. And we had it on VHS. And my siblings would watch it all of the time. And every single time that they watched it, I was the youngest child, and I was, even if I was scared, I insisted on watching it with them. But it was the scene where they have the beetles that go under people's skin, and you can see the legs move up their body, and then it like, goes up to their face. Oh my God.
Ah! Ah! A man! A man!
Oh, it was so gross. I would have a nightmare every single time. But I loved it. I love that movie to this day.
You loved getting creeped out. What about you, Stephen?
So my first horror memory is more horror movie adjacent. In 1977, I was 4 or 5. My family went to the Universal Studios lot, and they had just introduced a ride with the movie Jaws.
Nice. And I remember this ride.
Yes. And so my father was sort of, I remember him basically dangling me over the side of this boat. I don't think he was. He was a very good man. But basically, of course, the giant shark comes out of the water right directly by my face, my terrified, shrieking 4 or 5-year-old face. And so I really, that scarred me for, let's just say, life.
Well, that does raise the question, like, should we talk about, you know, that there is a distinction between horror movie genre and other things that are terrifying to kids.
Horror for adults often poses children as an object of terror.
Absolutely.
You know, like The Shining, the girls in the hallway, Poltergeist, The Grudge. There's always these like cursed, creepy children. Mm. And as an adult, I am afraid of children.
Children, Chucky, the doll.
Exactly. Absolutely. Right. So much of our adult horror is based off of childhood. But I think it's interesting, scary kids movies where the kid is the hero. And oftentimes the adults are kind of scary. Or like I think of like Coraline.
I want to be with my real mom and dad. I want you to let me go.
Is that any way to talk to your mother?
You aren't my mother.
Coraline's the hero. She is kind of taking on all of this horrific stuff, and the villain is the other mother, you know? It's like, what is this parent thing? And I think it's a different thing for a kid to watch something that's geared for them and to see themselves in these stories, I think, is a different thing than just seeing something that is scary when you're a kid.
Well, that leads me to the next question. Like, what are some examples of horror movies that are appropriate for kids? Is it seeing kids championed as heroes, or that's not necessarily?
For me personally, I think it's best when it is that. I don't know, Stephen, do you have?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a number of different ways to look at the question, because of course every kid is different and some things are appropriate for some kids but not others. Yeah. In my family, the greatest gateway into horror was Tim Burton. So Beetlejuice, yeah. Frankenweenie, The Nightmare Before Christmas. Cartoony, sometimes even actual cartoons that give the vibes and have the beats of horror, but there's a light touch. There's not viscera. There's an understanding of childhood. There's like a sense of childlike wonder. And when I think about my son, he's 24 now, but I remember him describing the first thing that really traumatized him in a movie was a scene in the movie The Incredibles, where they're kind of like going into a cave and they find the skeleton of like a superhero who has died. And that skeleton haunted him. Well, I didn't take my son to The Incredibles thinking, this is going to scar him, but good. But you can find trauma anywhere.
Yay. Maybe that's like an argument for it, too. It's like, look, they're going to be traumatized anywhere. I don't know. Maybe start them early.
Maybe this is
too much of a childless young person's perspective. I'm like, yeah, whatever. They'll get traumatized, however.
Well, okay. Well, then the next question I have is there an age, even though all children, each child is different and unique in this beautiful big world, is there still an age where it's too early to introduce that kid to a horror movie, would you say?
I think it really depends on the kid. And you can kind of read what is bothering your kid, what is deemed traumatic by your kid, what has bothered your kid. Like, for example, the fact that my son was bothered by that skeleton in The Incredibles meant, okay, I'm probably not going to sit down with him and watch The Evil Dead. But my daughter, I tell this story all the time, but when my daughter was, I want to say like 11 or 12, I remember tucking her in at night and turning out her light and kind of kissing her forehead and then hearing her sweet, inquisitive voice through the darkness, "Dad, have you ever heard of a movie called The Human Centipede?"
No. What did you say?
And so that's there to tell you is, first of all, you cannot control everything to which your child is exposed or everything your child knows about. Kids have access to the internet. Mm-hmm. Kids have access to other kids. Kids are constantly trying to shock and horrify each other.
Yeah.
The best advice that I can give to parents is to watch these things with your kids and talk with them, watch them process and kind of talk them through it. But also remember that every kid is different.
Yeah.
And remember that the human centipede is inappropriate for all ages.
All humans. Centipedes are not. Oh my God, you guys are so fun. That was All Things Considered producer Megan Lim and NPR music and pop culture critic Stephen Thompson. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you. That was fun.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. In its push to shrink government, the Trump administration has gutted AmeriCorps. That is the federal agency created 3 decades ago as a way for young Americans and seniors to serve their country. Now, most of the agency's staff has been fired, and more than 30,000 people have been ordered to stop their service work immediately. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Until last month, 25-year-old Theo Fauché was an AmeriCorps team leader. He and 10 others got a small stipend for building affordable homes in Virginia, removing hurricane debris in Florida, and repairing national park trails in West Virginia. That's where they were when Fauché got shocking news.
Pull your team off the work site, pack up your camp, hit the road tonight if possible.
The Trump administration had ended nearly $400 million in grants, yanking funding from more than 1,000 organizations, saying it no longer fit the agency's priorities. People were upset, Fauché says. He calls AmeriCorps a patriotic program that's good for the country and good for the young adults he led.
18, 19-year-olds who had never left home, who weren't really sure what they wanted to do with their lives or what was the right call for them, just traveled the country with people they'd never met before. The personal growth and agency and confidence I saw in these members was massive.
All of a sudden to have that opportunity ripped away from them is just unconscionable, really.
Kyra Esgate heads America's Service Commissions, a nonprofit that supports national service programming. She admits there have been issues. AmeriCorps failed 8 consecutive audits. A White House spokeswoman cited the same thing and pointed to $45 million in improper payments last year. Esgate says the agency found that in its own review, and AmeriCorps is upgrading a clunky IT system to better track money. Ann Maura Connolly with the nonprofit Voices for National Service says Democrats and Republicans alike have long supported AmeriCorps.
This is really an incredible story of the power of a person or a group of people to make a difference in their communities in ways that have ripple effects that go well into the future.
AmeriCorps transforms not just those who serve, she says, but also the students many teach and mentor. Connolly says small nonprofits and faith-based groups are reeling from this loss, and the funding can be crucial for local economies.
You know, folks in states like West Virginia, it's a massive opportunity to keep young people, talented young people in the state, help them get ready for careers and to really invest in their communities there. And they were hit hard by this.
It's also been a financial blow for many AmeriCorps service members. 26-year-old Medley Espinoza was helping bring in grants for a Chicago nonprofit that supports homeless families. Now, she doesn't know if she'll get the AmeriCorps Education Award she was counting on to help pay her community college student loan.
Anything that you were planning, maybe an expense or whatever, whatnot, now you have to scramble and think, how am I going to make up for that? So it's tough.
Right now, I am currently rudderless.
Nate Rabosa had only worked a few weeks helping the American Red Cross in Texas.
I still want to do like community work, like government or community, but they get paid by the AmeriCorps. And I am in limbo right now trying to find a job.
2 legal challenges have been filed over AmeriCorps' dismantling by community organizations and 24 Democratic-led states. Like so many other lawsuits against the administration, they allege that President Trump does not have authority to gut an agency that was created and funded for decades by Congress. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Multi-level marketing companies recruit salespeople with a message of abundant profit, but salespeople have to buy their products up front.
When companies do reveal the earnings statistics for how much people can actually make in this kind of side hustle, it's devastatingly low.
Bridget Reed on MLMs and her new book, Little Bosses Everywhere, Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Talks between officials from the U.S. and China in Geneva, Switzerland on trade issues today are expected to continue tomorrow. They're the first in-person talks since President Trump raised tariffs on some Chinese goods to as high as 145%, leading Beijing to retaliate. Pope Leo laid out his vision of his papacy, saying artificial intelligence is one of the most critical matters facing humanity. He also says he will follow the late Pope Francis and work to make the church more inclusive. And a half-ton spacecraft returned to Earth today, 53 years after it was launched by the Soviet Union on a mission to Venus. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. President Trump's idea to impose a 100% tariff on films made outside the United States has been a hot topic all week in Hollywood. And as NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports, it has put a spotlight on efforts to bring productions back to California.
Once upon a time in Hollywood, movie sound stages buzzed with film and TV productions, and you'd find crews on location everywhere in L.A.
Hooray for Hollywood!
But on-location production has been plummeting. The nonprofit group Film LA, which issues film permits in the area, found there were 30% fewer TV and feature film shoots in the first quarter of 2025 than the same time last year, which was already a low point. And LA sound stages were only 63% full last year.
People in this business in California describe this as an existential moment.
Film LA spokesman Philip Sokolowski says productions have still not rebounded from the COVID-19 pandemic and delays resulting from the Hollywood writers and performers strikes. But also, studios and streamers are just not ordering as many shows.
And with less work to go around, the competition for what's left is intensified.
Industry insiders say it's been heart-wrenching to see states like Georgia, New York, and Louisiana, and countries like Canada and the UK offer productions more incentives than California does.
So while it's true, so a lot of production has left the United States, it's even worse for California.
Sony Pictures Entertainment CEO and President Ravi Ahuja was in Beverly Hills Wednesday on a panel for the Milken Institute's Global Conference, along with other studio executives who say they like filming in L.A. But California's tax credit program needs updating, said Casey Bloys, the chairman and CEO of HBO and Max Content.
The talent is here. The infrastructure is here. We have a number of shows, including Hacks, that are shooting here. But the issue becomes when you're trying to plan, you have to get into a lottery, and you're not sure if your show is going to get the tax break or not.
Productions in L.A. have changed so much since 1928, when a silent film actor and director named Max Sennett transformed a lettuce ranch into what's now known as Radford Studio Center. In the 1990s, the hit TV show Seinfeld was taped here at Soundstage 9.
This stage has a ton of positive juju, Mandalit. People love to film on Stage 9, channeling the success of Seinfeld.
Zach Sokoloff is Senior Vice President at Hackman Capital Partners, which manages Radford Studio Center. On the day we visit, Soundstage 9 is quiet, so we ride in a golf cart to a back lot that was made to look like a New York City neighborhood.
You've got the balcony here where Jerry threw the marbled rye.
Sokoloff explains that Radford built this New York backlot for Seinfeld in 1994 after a massive 6.7 magnitude earthquake rocked L.A. and the studio.
There was trepidation about remaining in L.A., and so what we decided was to bring New York to the production as opposed to having the production go back to New York.
Building a replica New York City is what it took to convince Seinfeld to stay in California. But soon other states and countries began offering tax credits, rebates, and grants to shoot and film in their areas. After the hit show Ugly Betty relocated to New York to take advantage of that state's tax credits, California finally began offering incentives. In fact, the 2009 legislation was nicknamed the Ugly Betty Bill. Fast forward to today. After Trump introduced the idea of movie tariffs, California Governor Gavin Newsom volunteered to help the president craft a $7.5 billion federal tax credit plan. The governor has already been pushing to more than double California's tax credit program, and two bills going through the state legislature would expand the types of productions that are eligible for credits.
We have generations of people who have been in this business, who are in this area, who are the best of the best, and we need to protect that.
Pamala Buzik Kim is a co-leader of a grassroots group called Stay in LA. She says expanding tax credits would offer a reward, not a punishment like Trump's tariffs. Still, she's grateful for the conversation.
I mean, it definitely sent a spiral of confusion through the industry and through the international market. But the fact that we are getting attention at a national level is great.
Like so many others in this industry town, she hopes Hollywood can make a comeback. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
There was a moment during our live special coverage of Pope Leo's election that I will never forget. Leo, who up until that day was known as Cardinal Robert Prevost, was addressing St. Peter's Square in Italian.
La pace sia con tutti voi.
It had been an open question of whether we would have a live translation. We didn't. So NPR's longtime Rome correspondent, Silvia Pagioli, leapt into action.
Peace be with all of you.
Silvia Pagioli was a key part of NPR's coverage of the election of the first American pope. She's been a key part of NPR's Vatican coverage since the days of Pope John Paul II. A few days before the conclave began, I took a stroll through St. Peter's Square with someone that listeners have long viewed as one of the most iconic voices in NPR history.
We're about to go into the center of the square to try to have a little art history lesson.
Pagioli spent decades as NPR's Rome correspondent. In addition to having one of listeners' most beloved and recognizable outros,
Silvia Pagioli, NPR News, Rome.
Pagioli helped establish the sound and standard for our news network. This week's Reporter's Notebook begins with an art history and architecture lesson.
And we're standing here in the square, and this is the central visual of the Vatican, but it also, the setting has played a role in so many big ceremonial events that get international attention, papal funerals, installation masses, and it seems like the setting is as much of the story as what the cardinals and the popes are saying in the setting.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not so sure if it would look half as exciting, half as dramatic without this incredible square, the basilica, which was partially designed by Michelangelo, then Bramante, many other architects. But most of all, I think it's this colonnade that really gives it this dramatic sort of embrace, this round elliptical shape that's almost like this arms are embracing it.
Pagioli covered all sorts of different stories over the years, including difficult, challenging ones like the ethnic conflicts in the Balkans in the 1990s. But she says the Vatican was the most challenging. She wanted to take me to the middle of the square to look at that colonnade from a specific angle to illustrate that point. She guided us a few feet over and had me stand on a marble oval placed in the cobblestones just a few feet from the obelisk in the center of the square.
We're here in the center of St. Peter's Square. My father first brought me here when I was about 12, and he pointed this out to me. We're surrounded by the magnificent colonnade designed by the sculptor Bernini, we see four rows of columns that surround this elliptical square. Mm-hmm. Right now in the center, right near the obelisk, and from here we see only one column.
Yeah.
Now that's a trompe d'oeil, an optical illusion, and that optical illusions and shifting perspectives are some of the hallmarks of Baroque architecture. And Baroque is essentially the glorification of the Catholic Church's temporal power. When I started covering the Vatican, I remembered my father's art history lesson, and I began to see it as a metaphor for the Vatican's opaque, you know, sometimes secretive manner of presenting itself to the outside world, or at least to journalists.
This is the point where I should concede that Sylvia and I were not technically supposed to be recording in the middle of the square, where all the religious pilgrims and tourists were milling around. So art history lesson accomplished, we headed back to our broadcast booth just off the square to continue the conversation. Sylvia, what was it like walking into the Vatican press office for the first time?
Well, it was some 40 years ago, and it has been renovated since then. But I have to describe to you what it was like in the early 1980s. The first thing you'd see was a life-size sculpture against the wall of Christ crucified on a TV antenna. And I really didn't feel like that was a very encouraging sign about the...
Wow. What a passive-aggressive statement. Or maybe not passive
at
all.
That's the way I took it, Now, things have improved a lot over the years. There's been a much greater effort by the press office to hold press conferences with prelates and lay officials of the Vatican. But, you know, direct access to Vatican officials is not easy, especially for reporters who don't work for Catholic publications, for women reporters, and for reporters who don't work for well-known international publications and broadcast media.
Which I guess was the position you found yourself in.
NPR was not that very well-known here in Rome at that time. Now, the best access is for the Vaticanisti. That's Italian for Vaticanists. For them, it's a full-time beat. And they're experts at navigating the Vatican's formal and archaic bureaucracy, as well as they're really good at unearthing scoops in homilies and dense official documents. You know, but I found that sometimes the best sources were not prelates, but the sort of behind-the-scenes people, secretaries, ushers, and people like that.
And what about Vatican spokespeople?
You mean Vatican spokesmen, because they are always men. The first real Vatican spokesman was the Spaniard, Joaquin Navarro Valls. He was a combination spin doctor and a confidant of Pope John Paul II. And this was before the internet and social media, so he was in strong control of the message.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in 1998, I attended a press conference that was very hastily organized hours after a member of the Swiss Guards apparently killed Alois Esterman, his commander, and his wife, and then also himself.
Wow.
Navarro Valls, who was a psychiatrist by training, asserted that the alleged killer was in a state of psychological turmoil.
The investigation is being handled by a Vatican magistrate rather than being handed over to Italian authorities, as is the usual practice. But Navarro Valls expressed certainty that the current working hypothesis is credible.
And most probably the new data coming from the post-mortem will not change at all that reconstruction of the fact.
Navarro Valls ruled out...
So I'm curious, did that final report follow his preview of what it would be?
We never knew. We never found out really any of the real details of exactly what happened. It's one of the big mysteries surrounding the Vatican.
So that's Pope John Paul II. He's followed by Pope Benedict XVI, who in terms of communication styles was a very different pope. How was that reflected in the press office?
Oh, he was very different. He was much less outgoing. John Paul II had some contact with reporters on the flights, but Benedict much less so. He would take a few questions prepared in advance. His spokesman was Father Federico Lombardi, and Lombardi had to tackle many crises. Most notably, Benedict's remarks that suggested that the early spread of Islam had been accomplished through violence. Those remarks caused intense anger among Muslims and even death. And then there was Benedict's rehabilitation of a Holocaust-denying bishop that also caused an awful lot of uproar.
Is it true that there were moments in some of these controversies where the reporters covering the Vatican seemed more hyper-aware of, oh, this is going to cause a big global problem than perhaps the Vatican or the Pope himself realized in the moment?
Absolutely. In the case of Pope Benedict's remarks at Regensburg in Germany, we had the prepared remarks ahead of time. and the reporters read what he was about to say. He was quoting somebody who had made these remarks centuries earlier. It was not his direct quote, but he was quoting somebody that said, made a statement that was very, very controversial in modern times in the Islamic world. And a bunch of reporters did go to the spokesman, Father Federico Lombardi, and suggested that maybe he might want to say something that this to the Pope. And Lombardi said he could not, he would not approach him on that.
And that caused a massive, massive scandal that in many ways Pope Benedict never fully recovered from.
Not at all. There was that, and there were others. He was really afflicted by many, many scandals of this kind.
So that brings us to Pope Francis, who you've noted was really his own spokesman in so many ways.
Totally. He was absolutely his own spokesman. He often caught the Vatican press office off guard, announcing reforms, appointments. He even set up his own interviews. And he gave a lot of interviews to Spanish reporters, but also to many others. He did TV interviews. Now, one of the most interesting things Francis did was he engaged over several years in a public dialogue with a leading Italian newspaper editor. It was a fascinating intellectual exchange between the leader of the Catholic Church and a very staunch secular journalist.
Going back to that optical illusion that we saw a few minutes ago, you're taking me through the ways that the Vatican press office changed. I'm curious, over the years, were there ways that you changed the way that you tried to cover this institution?
I had to learn a lot about theology and religion.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had to do a lot of research. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was dense sometimes. It was very difficult. And you had to really learn how to interpret these very obscure language and dense theological statements.
Did you enjoy the challenge of covering this, or was it at times frustrating, or both?
Well, I think there were some really great moments. I think when John Paul II went to Israel, and it was in front of the Wailing Wall, and he, put a prayer in the crack. That was a very big event.
As his motorcade wound through the narrow streets, Pope John Paul was welcomed to Nazareth by singing, drumming, and cheers. But the town was also filled with Israeli police and border guards, some in full riot gear.
Another similar before that was when Pope John Paul II visited the Rome Synagogue.
Applause broke out when the Pope and Rome's chief rabbi, Elio Toaf, stood together in front of the Ark of the Torah at the beginning of the ceremony as the choir sang the Hallelujah. There were tears in the eyes of many of the...
It was the very first time in history that a Pope had entered a synagogue. To be in these historical moments was very big. The other time was with Pope Francis on the plain of Ur in Iraq.
And the Pope sat there with Muslim, Christian, and Yazidi religious leaders. It started with recitations from the Gospel and from the Quran.
To be there, where the land of Abraham, and to see Catholic and Islamic and religious leaders, it was pretty moving.
That is NPR's Silvia Pajoli. Thank you so much for telling us about this.
Thank you.
For Saturday, that is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Rome. Thank you to editor Courtney Dorning, producer Tyler Bartlam, as well as producer Erica Ryan for all of their work on our stories, bringing you the news of the first American Pope. And also thanks to producer Kat Lonsdorf. It's her last weekend on All Things Considered before she heads off to an exciting new assignment, and we will miss her. And thanks to you for listening. We will talk to you again tomorrow.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the University at Buffalo. The University at Buffalo is developing new AI technologies with the goal of solving some of society's most pressing challenges. More at buffalo.edu/AI. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.